Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, how the data on women's equality in Utah has changed through the years and how it hasn't. Governor Spencer Cox joins President Biden's Council of Governors, upping his bipartisan ties. And with the Delta variant of the coronavirus surging in the Beehive State, what do you need to know? Joining me in studio for this conversation, for the first part of this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter and Report for America core member Becky Jacobs. Thanks for being here, Becky.
Thanks for having me.
A pleasure to have you. And editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle is here in studio as well. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And a little bit later on the show, we're going to hear from Tribune senior federal government reporter Matt Canham and coronavirus data columnist Andy Larson. Stay tuned for that. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting to @KCPW or calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, we will spend the first part of the show talking about reporting on gender inequality in Utah. And Becky Jacobs, this week you published one of a series of stories examining the status of women in Utah. And I think listeners will be familiar with the idea that Utah is the worst state in the nation for women's equality. But you know, before we get into the digging on what you've done, what is that asserted fact that Utah is the worst state for women's equality? What is that based on? How do we define gender inequality and put Utah at the very end of the list?
Yeah, that's the tough question, right? I was brought to Utah for the Salt Lake Tribune to specifically report on this. And I joke, I did. That was the reputation I had of Utah before I moved here. I'm from the Midwest. And so the rankings that people probably see and are familiar with come from Wallet Hub. They routinely do a ranking of women's equality. And some people like to pick at that. They're like, oh, it's Wallet Hub, you know.
Sure.
Should we believe this? But there's really data that backs it up. And another institution that does these state-by-state comparisons is the Institute for Women's Policy Research. That's the one I really like to rely on, and they do a lot of these comparisons. And that also backs up that Utah, in a lot of these measures, is ranking towards the bottom among the states.
Yeah.
So I think it's a consistent thing. It's a general thought that's backed up by some data, as we're showing in this project.
And yeah, and the project looks at a variety of categories and breaks them down in this. Well, I mean, the project is you have one piece of the project that's out this week, and it is a sort of historical dive into these categories. And I'd like to break them down ourselves here on the show too. What can we say about the history and present of the gender wage gap? You know, and how that has been tracked in Utah, Becky.
Right. We looked at four categories that are some of the main ones used in these rankings. Gender wage gap is obviously one of them. And that's really one of the ones that we struggle the most. I mean, we've had one of the largest wage gaps in the country since 1989, so about three decades. And that's from Institute for Women's Policy Research data. And so it shows that, I mean, in all of these measures, we've made improvements over the years, and Utah's numbers have risen, but we're still lagging behind everyone else. So while our wage gap hovers around 70% for men and women's earnings, the national is more around 80%. So we just kind of are a bit behind.
But that we have made improvement, as you say, through the decades. I mean, I think that intuitively that makes sense. We have a different society today than we did before, and there was a period of time where women didn't have access to the same opportunities. Obviously, you know, credit cards, men would have to sign off on their husband's, you know, ability to get that. And then,
right.
And then there are built-in inequities as well. And again, this is data that's just tracked through the decades. And, and you can see a certain change, but we're still lagging behind the rest of the country. Is there any accounting for that? Why is that the case?
I think that's what we're trying to answer. I don't know if there's clear reasons. And, you know, like gender wage gap, when that comes up a lot, we have a lot of people who just anecdotally will talk about culture or our religious culture in Utah and how does that factor in. And that's a hard thing to study and figure that out. And so that's why earlier this year we did a study looking we wrote about a study that saw that how societies that are more religious and states that are more religious have larger gender wage gaps. And that's because of how they define gender roles. And it goes really deep. But I thought that was the first time we were able to kind of look at this this and be like, oh, that makes sense. So I think it's a lot of factors that come together that are hard to identify. And so that's why we tried to find these numbers to just do a baseline of, okay, how have we been doing?
Yeah. And it's probably hard to split out any of these categories individually because they all play into the same overall portrait. But there are other categories that you focused on. Another one was women serving as in elected office.
Right.
Where does Utah fall on the spectrum of states when it comes to elected office holders who are women right now?
Yeah, we specifically looked at state legislature. The most that there's ever been at one time of women in the Utah legislature is 27, and that was in 2020, so last year.
Okay.
And so that's still about a quarter of the 104 members. I think, you know, we were looking at that, and according to Rutgers, they track a lot of this, of how many women have served in the state legislatures. And Utah has ranked, you know, towards the bottom with how many we've had for at least since the early 2000s. So we just can't seem to break past that quarter amount. But I know there's a lot of effort to try to move that needle.
But that is an improvement. I mean, that's higher than it used to be, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah. We finally hit double digits. And then since then, we've been hovering in the 20s range. I think we're currently at 25 women for the 2021 session.
Okay. So Utah has lagged behind. Actually, how does that number, the 27, you know, the quarter or so of women who hold elected office at the state legislature, mm-hmm. state legislative level, how does that compare to the rest of the country? Is that still bottom? Maybe you told us that already.
I don't know if it's bottom. I think we do a little bit better in that category. Generally, women kind of, I mean, it was big news that I think it was Nevada that finally hit 50% of women in the state legislature. So I think a lot of states are still trying to work on this too. But I mean, it's not like the gender wage gap where I think we're still towards the bottom of the list.
Can I jump in for a second and just ask if this is something that you set out to focus on specifically as a reporter? Was this where you wanted to go when you got into journalism?
No, I started as general assignment, and then I covered crime in courts for about 4 years.
Yeah.
I had done, you know, as the women's marches started to happen in the last few years, I covered some of that. But then when I was looking at Report for America, this was the only women's issues beat, and it just sounded so interesting, and it clicked well, and I'm glad I took it. But I don't think it's a common beat. There aren't many reporters who focus on this specifically. One of the ones I follow is there's a news site called The 19th, and they cover gender and politics and news. But it's not like your education government cops beats that you usually see at newspapers.
Okay. Going back to that, to the data, one place where Utah women, you know, haven't lagged behind, it turns out, at least for a period of time, was in the sphere of education, at least when you compare Utah women to women overall in the United States. Becky, tell us about that.
Yeah, so we were looking at women with bachelor's degrees or higher, so bachelor's degrees, or they also have graduate degrees. And the data, there's been lots of great studies in Utah on this. And from 1940 to about 1980, we were ahead of U.S. women. And then we've kind of started to fall behind. And again, Utah women are earning more degrees. They're earning bachelor's degrees about the same as men in the state. But when you look at this bachelor's degree or higher, with that combined group, we're behind U.S. women, U.S. men, and Utah men. And so as I kept looking at this in these interviews, I would ask the experts, okay, why did we lose this educational edge? What happened? And I haven't gotten a clear answer on that yet, but I think that it's something to dig into, especially as we're encouraging more women to get higher degrees and finish them.
Wow. And this is, again, I guess the beginning of your dive into this. I know that you also you've surveyed Utah women, you've had conversations with, or not conversations, you sought feedback from Utah women. Maybe you can get some hints from that, I guess, and we'll expect more reporting on that. Another category is I think the final category, that of top jobs, meaning managerial positions that women hold. Where are we there in Utah, and what does the data show?
Yep, that again, we're improving, but we're still behind. I think it was 1994, we were like ranked 13th in the country. I mean, we were doing well compared to U.S. women. And since then, it's done a switch and we've fallen a bit behind, even though our numbers are still rising. And so that's just showing women that are in leadership positions in business and stuff in addition to our political representation category.
And again, the overall picture is improvement, but still a big gap. I mean, the gap is significant and it is there. Yeah, I guess you also at some point you compare us to our neighbors, meaning that like our nearby states, Idaho, for example, has had a higher percentage of women serving in the legislature. Is that right?
Right. When these rankings come out, usually we're sitting at the bottom with Idaho and kind of flip flop with them. Hmm. And so one of the big difference, though, between us is the political representation category. And I mean, they're in the kind of low 30s with how many women are serving there now. So, I mean, not a crazy amount higher, but it's still higher, and they hit our 27 mark long ago.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting to see someone that's so close to us in the rankings and see where our differences are.
It's very interesting, and I want to bring in George Pyle, editorial page editor on this, Becky Jacobs reporting on gender disparity. It's a complicated picture. I guess I'll ask you, what do you see in this data? What does it mean for our state and for our country and for the world?
Yeah, I mean, it is very complex, and it has to do with so many individual and family situations. A lot of women who go to college and then don't pursue a career, a lot of women who start college and don't finish. I mean, there's a problem with men doing that too. It is sort of got to be circular in a way. I mean, women growing up, do they see role models? Do they see other women in politics? Do they see other women at the heads of businesses? Do they see other women doing things they would like to do? And then even if they never meet that accomplished woman for any individual mentorship or anything, still have sort of this role model to pursue. You have to kind of break that barrier before much of anything else happens. And politics is a big part of it. We don't have any women in statewide office. There are already two geared up to take on Mike Lee in the Republican primary, but he's so entrenched. I don't know that gender is really going to have anything to do with that. He's just going to be really tough to knock off. And you have situations where, and then in politics, there's been some discussion of like when newspapers and radio stations write and broadcast about women in politics, how much of a deal are you supposed to make of the fact that they're the first woman to be this or that?
Right.
Does that set a goal? Does that say, look, you can do it? Or does that say, boy, this is really rare? And so you just well forget it because it's not going to happen to you too.
And Becky, that's something that you also wrote about, I think, earlier in, or maybe I can't remember if it was this week or last week, but the fact that newspaper coverage or that coverage in general of women, yeah, does focus on those firsts and tends to sort of separate them out. Is that right?
Yeah, that study is really complicated too, because a part of our job as journalists is we're quoting people of what they're saying. So should we be quoting what they're saying? What are we writing? There's a difference between, the news section and the opinion section. And I think what I took away from that report is, we should be marking that these are the first women in these roles. I mean, that's a big deal that it's taken this long to have some of these, Provo having its first female mayor. But I think the point of the research was go beyond just saying they're the first. Talk to them about the issues and the other things that they're working on too. And just one follow-up on statewide office. I think you were talking about Congress, but in terms of statewide office, we do have a female lieutenant governor right now, which is, she's the second one in the state for that.
Well, it's like, you go way back to like Doonesbury in the 60s, where the character Nicole comes in and she's just written a story about the president of Yale. I mean, I think they don't call it Yale, but it's Yale. And she describes him as a gray-haired, well-dressed grandfather, which, of course, that's the way they would describe a woman if she were the president of Yale. You never see a man described that way. You never see a man described by his hair color, whether he's well-dressed or not, whether he's a father or a grandfather. When they write about women in public, less so now than 20 years ago, but still it seemed like we always had to work in their family situation and their hair color and whether they were wearing a skirt or pants or all this kind of stuff. And it would just treat them differently. And there was all, there's still in politics and still in business I think probably I don't have any research on this, but one of the things that holds women back is the assumption by decision makers, whether they're voters or business executives, even other women who are thinking, well, this woman is going to be the one who stays home with the kids when they're sick. This woman is the one who's going to have to take days off to do things with the kids at school, whereas a man wouldn't. And the question is, you know, are more men going to do that?
Sure. The less so now than 20 years ago is, I guess, a statement of optimism.
Not completely gone. And it's just a matter of generations passing, probably.
Becky, maybe you have something to say about that. I don't want to cut you off.
No, that is a good point. That it is different now than then. And talking about the appearance, I mean, one of the things that the study pointed out was back when Olene Walker was governor, you know, the coverage was much different of talking about her as a grandma or, you know, comments about that. And so I think there are improvements where we don't see that in the reporting today. It's more kind of like unconscious bias or subtle things that is more present today.
You also, this week, Becky, had a quiz about gender inequity in Utah. This quiz was a list of statements, and it asked readers, whether the statement was about Utah women from the year 1964 or if it was about Utah women from the year 2019. And I will direct readers to that quiz, but maybe we could give a couple of examples here. One of the statements was, Utah has the highest rate in the country of women working part-time. And again, the question is that statement about 1964 or is it about 2019? Utah has the highest rate in the country of women working part-time. And I'm not sure how long to let the question stew before we give the answer, Becky, but is that 1964 or is that a couple of years ago?
It's 2019. One thing that's interesting when we talk about the wage gap is Utah women in the labor force is actually higher than the national rate for U.S. women, but we also have the highest rate of women working part-time. And I think that factors into the wage gap, too, because part-time positions tend to be lower paying.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, again, there's the why, this is what you're looking at is the why for that, and there's obviously probably no single why on that.
No, there's not. And actually, with that story that we did in 2019, because back then the Tribune did a survey of 400 women across the state on different questions about their status, and in the part time one, I mean, we made a pie graph of all the reasons that they said that they work part time, and there's a lot of them, and it's split a lot of different ways, so that. That shows why. it's a lot of reasons.
Again, check out this quiz. It's at sltrib.com in Becky Jacobs' story. Here's another one of the questions from the quiz, and this is, again, 1964 or 2019. Although women have been active in both political parties and in nonpartisan political activities, they haven't held public office to any great extent. Is that 1964 or is that 2019, whether or not they've held public office to any great extent? And the reveal, I don't have a drum roll, but Becky Jacobs, what's the answer?
That came from a 1964 report. And I think, again, that, we noted in the article with the quiz that a lot of these statements could apply to both time periods, arguably. But we've made improvements. But the question right before that one is, there are no women, Utah women serving in Congress. And that actually is true for both years. I mean, we've improved in some of our offices, but I mean, there's only been three women who've served in U.S. Congress from Utah.
Yeah, and again, Mia Love, Enid Greenwaldholtz.
And Reva, who was back in 1940.
Okay. Wow, that's interesting. And it is a statement that could be about 64 or 2019 that they haven't held public office to any great extent. But this was an actual quote, I guess, taken from a report in 1964.
Right. Our 1964 answers came from this report on the Governor's Commission on the Status of Women in Utah, and the 2019 quotes came from a reporting of that survey of women across the state in 2019.
I'm often struck by how recent the history is. You see some of this data and you look at it and you say, oh, it was only just that recently that we had X, Y, or Z thing happening, or that women were treated this particular way, or that the data shows this. But this is, sometimes you're confronted with the startling reality of the present as well, mm-hmm. George, and this question sort of embodies both of those things. Mm-hmm. Just before, we have to get to a break pretty soon, but Becky, a term that we've heard a lot about since you began reporting on this topic is the she session and COVID and the way that COVID has impacted women in particular in Utah. What does that look like?
Yeah, that's something we kicked off this project with an editorial explaining why we were doing this project. And one thing I noted in there is I don't think we could have known before I started the timing that this would have, because during the pandemic, we've seen that women have had a disproportionate share of job losses. And obviously with kids out of school and flexibility in working, I mean, women take a lot of the childcare responsibilities. And so as we've seen those numbers, you know, a lot of experts nationally, this isn't just Utah, this is all over, are worried about how that could set women back, especially as they've made advancements in the workforce or are keyed up for leadership positions. And so I think that's something that we have to be mindful of in our pandemic recovery, is making sure we're focusing on that too.
Well, pandemic recovery is something that we are going to talk about when we come back from a quick break. But first, let me say thank you to Becky Jacobs, who is a Salt Lake Tribune reporter and Report for America Corps member. Really interesting research, and I encourage listeners to go and dig into it. But thanks again, Becky.
Thank you. Yeah.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Becky Jacobs and George Pyle. It is our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments. Again, the number to call, 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, before we turn to a couple of recorded segments, and in fact, before we turn to our underplayed stories of the week, I want to ask editorial page editor George Pyle about a Salt Lake Tribune editorial. This will kind of lead us into a conversation with senior federal government reporter Matt Canham, because, George, the Trib penned an editorial about additional funding that is headed to both Utah and the nation. Some of that is a lock from the from unexpected growth in the economy and you know, tax increments that we're getting spending from. That's not the correct terminology. More money from taxes. Some of it is a little uncertain because it's part of the federal stimulus deal that has the deal on infrastructure that has been reached but hasn't been voted on yet. This editorial was a call for bipartisan cooperation and came, you know, just in time for the July 4th holiday, a sort of national unity editorial. Can you give us a sort of overview of this, George? People working together to try and plan with this massive windfall that we may be having, as much as $3 billion.
As you mentioned, the federal agreement that has been worked out by the bipartisan alliance in the Senate that includes Senator Mitt Romney hasn't been approved by anybody yet. It's out there. They have enough. If everybody sticks to this, it looks like they'll have enough votes. They won't have to do any fighting about whether the filibuster comes into play or whether it's done by reconciliation. It looks like they may have the votes. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's a smaller package, much smaller package than what President Biden has been campaigning for. And even if this passes, the White House and the Democrats are going to turn right around and try and pass an even larger package, infrastructure package, which includes things that Democrats say is infrastructure, but a lot of Republicans don't think it qualifies because it's softer stuff like education, school lunches, aid to seniors, and things like that, that some people say, well, that's not infrastructure because you're not stirring concrete, so therefore it doesn't count. The package that looks like it has a chance of passing does include things like broadband, in expanded broadband for rural areas and places that don't have it now, and includes funding for education and looking at a lot of money that the feds are going to try and spend to help children catch up for the schooling they lost during the pandemic. Meanwhile, in Utah, the coronavirus pandemic, quite reasonably, caused a lot of people to think the economy was really going to crash, that the tax revenues would go way down. The legislature accommodated for that, cut approved spending levels, then come to find out that the economy didn't do all that bad between people working at home, people ordering DoorDash, federal money that has been appropriated and spent and found its way into people's pockets. The Utah economy has actually been holding up rather well. And now we're looking at maybe $3 billion more than the bean counters had anticipated. So now how are we going to spend that? Yeah. And I do think that there is reason to believe that the legislature is going to try and make wise use of this money, going to try and put it into things that we can keep after this is gone, that they're not going to put it into salaries so much or things like that. They're going to build roads with it. They're going to buy trains with it. They're going to improve front runner commuter rail service.
Is that what's going to happen?
I would think it would, because I do think there's a move, an understanding in the legislature that this may be a one-time bonus. And we need to spend it on things that after the bonus is gone, after perhaps the economy isn't doing so well, or at least just kind of levels out, that we'll still have these roads and these trains and these tracks and these high-efficiency buses and things like that.
This instead of a big tax cut.
Exactly. Instead of the knee-jerk reaction of most Utah legislators, which is they get a dollar ahead and they want to have a tax cut. And that's often what happens. Now, like Governor Herbert, he was more interested in putting it into education because he was pretty good about any time there was any change in the couch cushions, he wanted to put it into schools. And he had a lot of success getting that through the legislature. And at the same time, we have this report now about how we're going to be getting up to Snowbird and Alta. And they're down to two now. They did away with the railroad, which was my favorite just because I like trains. They're looking at widening the road and having a lane dedicated to buses so that the buses can run a lot more often and attract people, or they're looking at this
giant gondola
project, which sort of is a Swiss European way of dealing with ski lifts, although the way I understand it, this would be really long, that most Swiss and German gondolas don't go this far. So, and both of them are really expensive.
Well, and there are, you point to surveys, there's a public comment period for that that you can get involved in. Check it out at sltrib.com. We're just about to turn to our underplayed stories, but you write in the editorial board of the Tribune writes that the hazard to be avoided is not that we spend too much or too little, but that we make decisions based on partisanship, habit, and fear. And you issue a call that we do the greatest good for the greatest number of people and improve lives. Check out that editorial at sltrip.com. George, I don't mean to cut you off, but we are running low on time, and I want to already turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight shows that maybe people didn't see or that you want to just draw extra attention to. And Becky Jacobs, we will turn to you first for a pick for underplayed story. What do you got?
Yeah, mine is a shout out for Alex L. Cabrera. She's our new Report for America Corps member that's covering the west side of the valley. She started with us this summer, and one of her first stories just came out today looking at the new Taylorsville Police Department and how that's going to work. And it's a Q&A. It's easy to read, and I'm excited for the stories that she's going to have.
And she's another Report for America Corps member, meaning that sort of embedded at the Tribune, but getting, there's extra funding that comes from Report for America.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. That's exciting news. Check that out. Check out that first report from Alex L. at sltrip.com. George Pyle, I know you don't like the title, but a pick for underplayed story.
This is underplayed in the sense that we should be talking about it all the time, every opportunity we have, and that is to get damn vaccinated. I mean, people have given up on wearing masks. People have given up on staying home. People are no longer going to tolerate remote education or closed schools because they're just tired of it. But as the governor is pointing out, I mean, practically in tears, like 98% of the people who get sick were not vaccinated. If you get vaccinated, you almost certainly won't get it. And if you get it, you almost certainly won't die. So, okay, we've given up on masks. We've given up, one third full at Vivint. We've given up on all that. the way we're going to survive that is for everybody to get vaccinated, and there is no logical reason except for the fear-mongering you hear on Fox News why everybody over the age of 12 shouldn't be vaccinated now. You can go to Walgreens. You can go to Harmon's. Roll up your sleeves. It's free, for crying out loud.
George Pyle, with a plea to everyone and a repeated plea that we've been hearing from a lot of people in government as well. And, it's protect yourself. Thanks for that pick. George, for my part, I'm going to go with some reporting that Sarah Tabin did, and it has to do with the diminished Great Salt Lake. The lake is approaching its lowest ever recorded level, and millions of birds are imperiled as a result. For the KCPW program In the Hive, I piggybacked on one of Sarah's sources and talked about eared grebes and pelicans and the situation for them. And basically, with just a little bit more drying and a slight increase in salinity, we could see, you know, huge impacts to these species, you know, the near erasure of some species. And what's interesting is that this isn't so much about the drought, actually, as it is about decisions that policymakers are taking, and that is what's causing this disaster, at least according to the researcher that I spoke with who studies some of these species. So check that out at SLTrib. Check mine. That's that podcast out at kcbw.org. Sarah Tabin's piece on the Great Salt Lake is at sltrib.com, as is everything else that we've been discussing on the show today. For now, though, we're going to say goodbye to our two in-studio guests, Becky Jacobs and George Pyle, both with the local newspaper of record. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah. With that, we will now turn to my conversation with Tribune senior federal government reporter Matt Canham, and reporting he did this week touched on bipartisanship and, well, on something that isn't that. Take a listen. Matt Canham, senior federal government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here.
Happy to.
So yesterday you reported on the fact that Utah Republican Governor Spencer Cox is joining something that Democratic President Joe Biden is convening, the Council of Governors. Some signs of bipartisanship in the 21st century in the United States of America, Matt, which is maybe nice. I don't know. But tell us what this Council of Governors is.
You know, I hadn't heard about the Council of Governors before, but apparently it was started in 2010. Spencer Cox is the first Utahn to be involved in it. It is a group of governors who counsel the president on issues of national security, homeland security. We're talking about cyber warfare. We're talking about terrorism. We're talking about how to use the National Guard in emergencies like wildfires or earthquakes.
Wow. And so these guys will be advising the president on a variety of issues? Just is it occasional check-ins? How will it work?
I'm not exactly sure about the formal meetings, but Cox is one of 10 governors, and they also include the Secretary of the Defense, the Secretary of Homeland Security, the person in charge of FEMA. This group will meet in some sort of fashion to help the president interact with these issues. One thing I will say is, even in this early part of the Biden administration, Governor Cox has been a part of multiple events where the president has sought input from governors.
Yeah, you reported that Cox has been engaging with the Biden administration. It's a bit of a running theme for him. Has he said why?
Well, I think, you know, today he said that he wanted this so Utah has a seat at the table. And I think when you look at the issues in which Governor Cox has interacted with the president, it's about the vaccine rollout or wildfires. These are things that don't necessarily have to be partisan. We're not talking about abortion rights in the Council of Governors. We're talking about things that are pretty nonpartisan. The Council of Governors is also promoted heavily through the National Association of Governors. There's a group that the governors represent a state's interests, and that is a bipartisan effort. And this council has a Republican chairman and a Democratic chairman.
So by design, bipartisan is the
idea. By design.
That's interesting. You know, I think we could linger here, Matt, but I'd like to squeeze in one more topic that you covered this week. And maybe by way of transition, I'll say that the name of what we're about to talk about defines it as a very not bipartisan initiative, the Conservative Climate Caucus. You and I have talked about this before on the show. Utah's Representative John Curtis is one of the founders of this group, I believe. Curtis says that Republicans, you know, despite their history of on occasion denying the problem, they too care about climate change.
However, this week you reported that a local environmental group says they are not so certain about that. Maybe just tell us about the reporting that you did on this.
Yeah, when the Conservative Climate Caucus was originally created, it had about 50 members. It's grown since then. This is a lot of different Republicans, including every member of the House delegation from our state. And they have a range of opinions. Some of them are pretty new to being able to say publicly that they think the climate is changing and that pollution is part of it. Some of them are a little bit more engaged in the topic or have been, like John Curtis. Now, initially when this happened, environmental groups were pretty hesitant to criticize right out of the bat. They wanted to see what kind of results, but they were glad that it was created. Well, 2 days after they created it, the House voted on a methane rule. And this involves leaks of methane. This is largely around natural gas pipelines that the Obama administration wanted to crack down on those leaks so we're not just wasting gas into the air. The Trump administration tried to ease those rules. Well, this Congress voted to go back to the way Obama had it and to remove leaks of methane so that you're not just pumping out greenhouse gases for no purpose. And John Curtis and the vast, vast majority of the Conservative Climate Caucus voted against that idea. And that caught the eye of some environmentalists.
Yeah, who say, hold on a second, this is a vote that shows that you're not helping with emissions that are impacting the climate. The Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance was among those who criticized Representative Curtis on this. And am I right, Matt, that industries themselves wanted to see these rules reinstated?
Yeah, and it wasn't uniformly industry, but big companies like Shell and BP, they were behind this saying, go for it. The big national oil and gas companies were not in any way trying to stop this from happening. And for a group like SUA, their argument was a vote doesn't get easier than voting against leaking methane. You know, this isn't saying don't use natural gas. It's saying just make sure that you're not just wasting it. And they thought that this was a sign that the Conservative Climate Caucus could just be for show.
Hmm. Sort of window dressing to give them permission to vote just like that, I guess. What do the members of the Conservative Climate Caucus, or what does Representative John Curtis say about his vote on that methane rule?
John Curtis said that he was worried that the United States was putting itself at its disadvantage to foreign companies. His concern when it comes to this kind of stuff is that if you add cost to U.S. companies and we're not competitive, then it doesn't mean that the world's not using fossil fuels. It just means that you hurt a U.S. company. And for him, he wants to make sure that the solutions are about global climate change and not emissions in just Utah or in the United States.
I mean, arguably, any regulation on industry would be an added expense that would make it less competitive, but it might be beneficial for human health or the environment. I'm missing the participation of a columnist right now, Matt. But and is it just SUA saying this? We can wrap up here, Matt. Is it just SUA pointing this out now?
SUA was the one that pointed it out, but they're not the only ones who have questioned whether the Conservative Climate Caucus is going to come up with serious solutions and votes that really move the needle when it comes to emissions.
Okay. Well, we will wait and see, although it seems like we've been waiting and seeing for a long time. Once again, missing the columnist here. Matt Canham is senior federal government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Really appreciate your reporting on this, Matt. Thanks.
Thank you.
Again, that's the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, and I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and on Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break in the show and be back with data columnist Andy Larson and a look at the Delta variant of the coronavirus in Utah. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Excuse me, I'm not joined by anybody, actually. We are. This is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio and featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. And now on the show, we're going to turn to my conversation with the Salt Lake Tribune's Andy Larson and his look at the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus here in the state of Utah. Andy Larson is a pandemic data columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, in addition to being Utah Jazz beat writer. And Andy, thanks for being back on the show.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Of course, though maybe the very fact that you are on the show and that we are having this conversation should be a little bit concerning because, you know, we haven't heard from you a while on this particular front, on the coronavirus beat. So why did you come out of your coronavirus, you know, pandemic data columnist hibernation, Andy?
Yeah, look, I mean, this Delta variant is a real threat. And so, you know, I've been getting a lot of questions from people about it, and it is something that does kind of change the numbers of the pandemic in a significant way. And, you know, as much as we were reducing cases and really kind of on the right path with this thing, all of a sudden that's really changed in the last couple of weeks. And, you know, culminating with what happened in the middle of the week this week, where, you know, we saw nearly 700 cases reported in a single day. So all of a sudden, you know, we're not out of this thing, and it has kind of bubbled back up thanks to this Delta variant here in Utah.
This has been defined before, but just a quick, you know, remind us what this is. It's a mutant form of the coronavirus, right?
Correct. And, you know, originally it was found in India, and it basically has mutations in it that make it more contagious for people who have the disease. So it binds easier to the human cells. So it's creating more of these virus particles that then mean that it's easier to spread from person to person. And then it seems to evade antibodies to some extent as well, which makes it a little bit harder to fight as well. So it's got about 30 different mutations in kind of compared to coronavirus classic, if you want to call it that. And, you know, as a result, it acts just a little bit differently from what we're used to.
Got it. It's like the new Coke versus original Coke. But that's not a very good analogy.
It is an analogy because just like new Coke, this one is worse than the original.
I love it. So again, I know that earlier this week, hospital or state health officials, they said that, you know, the vast majority of cases that we're seeing now, 80% or more of the spread that's happening in Utah is of this Delta variant. How worried should we be? And maybe we can break it into categories. There are people who are vaccinated. There are obviously people who are not vaccinated. I think the simple answer is if you're not vaccinated, you should be worried.
Yeah, agreed. And look, the good news is that the people who have been vaccinated show significant protection against this variant as well. You know, it's about 90 to 95% effective in terms of just preventing the disease overall, especially if you've had two doses of the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine. And as far as preventing hospitalization and death, it's even more effective, kind of in that 95% to 100% effective range for preventing hospitalization and death for the Delta variant if you've had those two mRNA vaccines. Then there's kind of a medium level of protection, which is where if you've only had one dose of a vaccine, whether that be an mRNA vaccine or the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, it does seem that that has, you know, provides a little bit lower level of protection, which is something that we've kind of known all along with the virus in general. But, you know, somewhere in that kind of 60% range in terms of effectiveness, when it comes to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So, and then of course, then you have the people who have not been vaccinated whatsoever, which we know we have in Utah. And those people are in, you know, again, that legitimate risk of having, this Delta variant have significant, you know, impacts on their lives.
Yeah. You said that a lot of the data that we have here comes from Britain, where they keep a lot of good data on the virus. And I don't want to deviate too far here, but there's further evidence from that you've been digging into that's kind of related to this that says that if you've had the virus and you've recovered, that's no reason to not get the vaccine. We should, I guess, maybe kind of dispel that myth a little further.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, you kind of can think of it as it's almost like getting one dose of the vaccine, right? Like it is a little bit more effective than just getting one dose of the vaccine, but it is. Your body has encountered this virus once, and so it's putting up kind of a moderate to pretty good level of protection against variants like the Delta variant, but it's not as effective as someone who has been vaccinated or as effective as someone who has been infected and then vaccinated, right? So being vaccinated twice really helps because it kind of tells your body, hey, This is an ongoing you need to be worried about, and you need to continue to antibodies for it. So kind of either if you can expose your body in a way that you want it to be, i.e. through vaccination and two-dose vaccine like Pfizer and Moderna, you're probably in the best shape. If you've had it before and then can be vaccinated, then that also kind of, again, shows your body that, hey, this is going to be an ongoing threat that you need to be worried about.
Okay. And then your body responds to that. Just again, the rapid spread of this variant is happening among the unvaccinated. A big group of Utahns who fall into that category are school kids. How dangerous is the Delta variant to those kids?
Yeah, no, it's a fair concern. And, you know, obviously the scientists are still working on getting a vaccine available for those who are under 12. And, right now kids 12 and over can get the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, but this is relatively a concern. And again, we go back to Britain because of their excellent data collection to figure out what kind of risk this presents to kids, because Delta is the main variant there as well. And what we found is a small but relatively insignificant rise in hospitalizations among children in Britain. So, you know, it got to at the low point of the pandemic in Britain, we got to about 5 cases per 7 days, or in terms of kids under 17 being hospitalized in Britain. Now we're up to 7. So, you know, it's still not very many. You know, at the peak of the pandemic, we saw upwards of 40 kids being hospitalized every week in Britain. Now we're in, again, 5 to 7. So there's no indication that the Delta variant is worse for children. And certainly, you know, we're seeing kind of the stats kind of hold up that we saw earlier in the pandemic, that, hey, look, you know, COVID is less of a concern for children than it is for adults. And, you know, it's kind of a smaller risk than some of the other kind of major reasons that kids end up in the hospital or die, right? You know, things like drownings in pools or car accidents, or, you know, even the regular flu is in many ways more damaging to kids than COVID is.
Wow. Behaviorally, I guess, Andy, what should we all be doing? I mean, with the knowledge that that this Delta variant is spreading more rapidly. I mean, you just pointed out that it's a measured risk for children. Obviously, the biggest risk is for, I guess, unvaccinated adults then. But how should both the vaccinated, the fully vaccinated, and those who are not vaccinated be behaving?
Yeah, I think it really kind of depends on the community that you're in and kind of your ultimate risk level, right? So those with high levels of comorbidities, you know, if they've got diabetes, have weight issues, whatever the case may be, are naturally going to be at more risk. And so, again, if you're in that situation where it is going to be dangerous for you, and you know, you're concerned about a breakthrough case, I think that's fair. And I think it's, you know, worthwhile to avoid situations in which the virus may be spreading. You know, 12 counties this week moved into the high transmission index in Utah. So, kind of being around other vaccinated people, probably the way to go, even if, you know, regardless of whether or not you are vaccinated. If you're not vaccinated, then the solution is to get vaccinated and give yourself a really high level of protection against this variant. Because the truth is that the average contagion rate for this virus is, you know, without interventions, one sick person gives it to about on average 5 to 8 other people. And that means exponential spread of this Delta variant among the unvaccinated. So again, the solution there is consistent advice of health experts everywhere, right? But the Delta variant makes it much more important and kind of a more pressing threat.
I guess I want to just follow up for one more second. You know, you've got fully vaccinated people. We've seen a great sort of opening up of society, fully vaccinated people heading to the restaurants and bars. Do you want to give any advice to them? I mean, it's hard to know when you go to a bar or a restaurant who's vaccinated, who's not vaccinated. The risk to you is pretty small, but, you know, are you doing something incorrect when it comes to, like, sort of the public health, strategy if you go to the bar and you don't, you know, wear a mask, or if you are close to people? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I understand. And it's one of those things where it is so individual at this point, right? Because if you have been vaccinated and you are, you know, kind of in that low to moderate risk category where you're not elderly, you don't have these comorbidities, then, you know, I honestly don't think there's anything to worry about. And the health experts would agree on that this shouldn't be a concern for you if you've done the things that, you know, you should do and you're in relatively good health. Where I think you start to kind of consider whether or not you should go to that bar, or you know, how many people you have around you or whether or not you're being hanging out in kind of crowded locations is when you do have a higher risk, whether you, you know, whether that's someone being elderly or again, having multiple comorbidities that make COVID really dangerous. So ultimately, yes, if you're highly, if you're vaccinated, you're highly protected, but yes, breakthrough cases happen. Typically breakthrough cases on average are less severe than kind of the standard COVID case. And I think that's something to know as well, but there are people who have had breakthrough cases and get hospitalized and then die. You know, it's rare, but it does happen. So again, I would look at your individual risk level and your individual risk factors to determine whether or not going out or being with a bunch of people is a good idea.
Yeah, and maybe weigh that against the sort of general risks of living your life. Andy Larson is a Tribune data columnist and reporter of a great many things. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, a reporter of a great many things. You're welcome. You can put that on your tagline.
Again, you can find Andy Larson's explainer on the Delta variant of the coronavirus over at sltrib.com, as well as everything else that you've been hearing about on the show today. That does it for our show. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Podcasts are available at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week. Stay cool out there. Really hot conditions predicted in much of Utah for the next few days. Again, thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines. Join us again next week.